Introduction: An office is born. No office on earth brings with it greater influence than the US presidency does, but with unimaginable power comes unthinkable responsibility. Understandably enough, many holders have felt themselves to be all but crushed beneath the weight of their country's idealistic expectations. America was an ideal before it was ever an actual nation. The founding fathers had a vision and made it real. They looked across the Atlantic to an old world in which power was chronically corrupt, from the courts of kings to the palaces of the papacy. It should have been so different, of course. Philosophers like Francis René Descartes and scientists like Sir Isaac Newton in England had ushered in an age of enlightenment. Their insights had helped clear the way to a new understanding of the universe. There was no need for people to be kept down in ignorance or chained in poverty any longer. Humankind had a very special destiny. Knowledge, the Enlightenment thinkers saw, could set men and women free. Reason could come to the rescue of the oppressed. Far from being blind to these new developments, Europe's tyrannical rulers saw and understood them all too well. They had no interest in giving up their privileges and power. Neither did a Catholic Church whose leaders were hand in glove with Europe's kings. They did their best to suppress the new learning and the spirit of liberty that went with it. And overall, it has to be admitted that they didn't do badly. The mass of people were lost in suppression and sunk in superstition. Fathers and faith. Men like Benjamin Franklin, Thomas Jefferson, John Adams, and Alexander Hamilton were thinkers first and founding fathers only second. Their ambition in establishing the United States wasn't to set themselves up at the head of a new nation, but to break what was becoming an intolerable British hold on their country and to realize the reign of enlightenment on earth. For the most part, they distrusted religion, or at least any role it might assume in the running of the state. Looking to Europe, they saw a collaborationist Catholic Church whose cardinals cavorted with mistresses, while their priests bamboozled the peasantry with Latin, justifying their poverty and oppression. So even the believers among them were eager to sign up to the famous secularism of America's Constitution. No one, however virtuous, would dictate to others what they should believe. Yet it wasn't quite so simple. The new republic may have been an avowedly secular state, but at the popular level it had, then as now, a religious streak a mile wide. Many of the first settlers had, of course, been Puritans, devout Protestants fleeing persecution by the authorities of the Anglican Church in England and by established churches elsewhere in Europe. For them, the New World represented a safe sanctuary for their Protestant observances, and they quite naturally saw their lives here not just as an emigration but as a spiritual rebirth. And, though many of America's leading intellectuals did regard themselves as freethinkers, who'd left their inherited Christian beliefs behind, they were more concerned with upholding religious freedom than with stamping out religion. They were secularists because they didn't want one dominant church or movement trampling another's rights, rather than because they wanted to abolish religion altogether. All eyes on America. Not that there was any great likelihood of this ever happening. America feared God more than it feared its founding fathers. No taxation without representation may have been the colonists' call to arms when the crunch with England came, but religious resentments had been bubbling under for generations. If America felt it was a place apart, it wasn't because the Atlantic Ocean separated them so emphatically from the old world in geographical terms, but because its people felt they were striking out in a new direction morally and spiritually. They were engaged, they strongly believed, in building a new society that wasn't going to be sinful like the old. That's not to say that there weren't no goods and ne'er-do-wells among the colonists. Of course, man for man and woman for woman, they probably weren't any better than anyone else. The feeling was strong that they should be, though, and whatever weaknesses this or that individual might have, they shared a strongly rooted moral purpose. America wasn't going to be a nation like all the rest, its people told themselves. It had a special responsibility to show the way. It had been the Protestant preacher John Winthrop who'd first voiced the idea of the city on a hill. The phrase came originally from Christ's Sermon on the Mount, Matthew 5:13-16, of course. Jesus warned his followers that the whole world would be watching the way they lived. The city on a hill stands out in pride, he pointed out, but potentially also in disgrace. Its actions can't be hidden from the world at large. It's an example to everyone, its deeds and misdeeds promptly judged. In all probability, The founding fathers never even knew Winthrop had existed. His works weren't widely circulated till well on in the 19th century. What's striking to us today is not so much that they signed up to Winthrop's Christian beliefs, because they clearly didn't, as that they shared his intense self-consciousness, his feeling that he and his little community were on display. The founding fathers too felt that their great project was exposing America to the unsparing judgment of outsiders, that they had to be seen to be better than those from whom they were breaking free. That sense has never left America in the centuries since, and though Winthrop's phrase has become a cliché, it's never quite lost its power to stir the spirit. Yet if it's been a source of enormous patriotic pride, it's also been a constant cause of anxiety and shame, because moral perfection is hard for humans to achieve. Yet the United States has always felt at some level that this is what's required, that its leaders should stand out as exemplars. A question of standards. It's important to remember just how unusual this is. In most times and places, people have viewed their leaders more skeptically and more tolerantly. The view that every French politician of any importance will have at least one mistress may be a stereotype, but history tells us that it's frequently been true. And there have been many countries in which financial corruption has been endemic, within reason, indeed, it's been accepted as okay. The Roman Empire didn't for the most part hold itself up as a beacon of morality, except in so far as might was right. And whilst the decadence of the imperial court was nothing less than legendary, the legions upheld the military virtues to the very end. The same went for the kings of medieval and early modern Europe. Bad behavior was more or less expected. What mattered was the authority of their rule. No one really minded that Britain's Charles II had so many mistresses. The antics of the merry monarch merely drew a smile. As for the Rome of the popes, well, for sure, the successor of St. Peter was supposed to set high standards, but this was a fallen world, with everything that implied. Ever since Eve and Adam ate the fatal fruit, mortal men and women had been but sinners. They should strive, but we had to forgive them when they failed. Does it make America better that it expects much more of its politicians? That's actually very difficult to say. Do we judge by our moral aspirations, the standards that we set, or rather by the reality, the fact that so many fail to meet them? Yet, easy as it is to sneer at the hypocrisy that so regularly seems so deeply embedded in the American way, would it really be better to accept an ethical free-for-all? It's got to be a good thing, surely, that we expect our representatives not to sell their influence to the highest bidder or enrich themselves at our expense. Even if then they go ahead and do it anyway. All the president's powers. The powers of the presidency are immense, and always were, even at the outset when the United States were just a bunch of upstart colonies. Though he himself was democratically elected, the president was accorded enormous authority by the Constitution of 1787, which gave him an effective right of veto over measures passed by the legislature. In principle, and frequently in practice, that means one elected official squashing laws agreed by other elected officials. But then democratic government has always been about the art of compromise. The president gets to appoint key members of the judiciary and, though in theory always accountable, has sweeping powers to overrule state legislatures. He can also withhold information from Congress when, in his view, there are grounds of national security. Whilst in theory the right to declare war is reserved to the elected legislature, the United States has actually declared war only 5 times in its entire history. That's right, 5. Effectively, the president has the right to send U.S. troops wherever he feels they're needed. Presidents have acted without congressional say-so over 120 times. There's no doubt that, with the powers invested in him, the U.S. president is in a position to a great deal of good, and conversely, of course, a great deal of harm. The moral responsibilities of a U.S. president are commensurately awesome, in some ways that might be seen as an unfair burden. Even in American political discourse we talk in principle of the separation between the man and the office, but it's harder to maintain this separation in fact. A corrupt cardinal wore his scarlet robes when serving in his official capacity as prelate. He took them off, one assumes, when tumbling with his mistress. A European king's authority was unquestioned, but it was vested clearly in his crown and scepter. When he put those aside, he was just another man, albeit a very rich and privileged one. But when we look at Barack Obama, just as when we looked at George Washington, the man and the statesman are very recognizably the same guy. And so it's always been. It's perhaps an impossible tightrope that the president has to walk, to be extraordinary and ordinary at the same time. The photos in this book underline it. As presidents don't wear ceremonial robes unless they're being awarded honorary degrees by universities or colleges. They stand before us as men, important men, certainly, in frock coats and business suits, like so many millions of middle-class Americans of their age. Often they pose with their first ladies looking like the other hostesses of their time, elegantly turned out, to be sure, but clearly of this world. Britain's recent elections have brought talk of an Americanized style of politics in which party leaders have been put forward in a presidential manner. One key ingredient has been a frenzied media war of the wives. US presidential TV debates often dwell disproportionately, to European eyes, on a competitive assertion of family feeling on the candidate's part. A regular guy who likes a beer and a commander-in-chief with his finger on the nuclear trigger, a man who can talk baseball and trade treaties with equal ease, a man, or soon perhaps a woman, who must be seen to put country above all else, yet who has to be seen to put family above all else as well. Cronies and corruption. One other tradition which sets the US system apart from that of many other democracies is the extent of the president's freedom to make personal appointments to his administration. Work which in other countries would fall to elected officials or career civil servants, long-time professionals, is given instead to the trusted friends and advisors of the president. There are advantages and opportunities for abuse. Civil servants become set in their ways. They have an overpowering instinct to stick to the tried and tested when what presidents want, what electors have often voted for, is change. At the same time, though, they have a long training for what they do. They have clear hierarchies which help ensure that their work and the decisions they make are strictly overseen. They also have a loyalty to the state as a whole, which goes beyond the obligation they may feel they owe to the man who for the moment is their chief. Practically every presidential candidate trumpets his claims to be an outsider in the alien world of Washington, D.C., but there's no doubt that the nation's capital can be a strange and forbidding place. Yet, whilst it's natural for the man in what can be the loneliest job in the world to want to surround himself with people he knows he can rely on, too often they know they can rely on him for favors. Over time, it's very clear, cronyism has been one of the besetting sins of the US presidency. Vying a voice. The rise of the professional lobbyist has been one of the more depressing trends in modern American political life, though its founding principle could hardly be more democratic. Every American has the right to take his or her concerns to the government in Washington. You wouldn't want it any other way. The first organized groups of lobbyists got underway during the railroad boom of the 19th century. Rich and powerful railroad barons wanted government subsidies for their projects. After all, they argued, they were serving the economy and the public good. Lobbyists had learned the ropes. They had schmoozed the main officials in the administration. It made sense to subcontract this work to them. Other groups over time were to lobby for punitive tariffs on imported textiles or to see safety or environmental regulation eased. Lobbying has become a multi-billion-dollar industry. Critics say it enables entrenched interest groups to buy the legislation that they want. They don't generally do it outright, of course, but by plying the already powerful with freebie trips and lavish gifts, they can have a powerfully persuasive impact on the way we are all governed. Under George W. Bush, it's been alleged, more than 100 one-time lobbyists were appointed to regulators' roles, supposedly policing the activities of industries for which they were formerly paid advocates. Yet Obama's promise to exclude all lobbyists from his administration has hardly stood up to scrutiny. But then, that's part of the problem. One man's lobbyist is another's fighter for justice. President Truman put it in almost so many words. Asked by a reporter whether he'd object to lobbyists who were working for his program, he replied, "We probably wouldn't call those people lobbyists. We would call them citizens working in the public interest." Sexual politics. Few would argue with Henry Kissinger's claim that power is the great aphrodisiac. It acts on both the office holder and on potential sexual partners. What we see in workplaces is replicated in the White House. The boss has allure, and some ability to compel. Some women may see a tryst with a president as a triumph, If sex is a competition, that's not surprising. Others may see the Oval Office couch as the quickest way to influence. Others yet may feel they're romantically rescuing a man they see as misunderstood. Not that the president is innocent in such cases, easy as it is to see how one could let oneself be carried away with these particular privileges of power. The man with the world at his feet is, of course, only too likely to feel he has its women at his beck and call, and his office gives him a glamour he might not otherwise have possessed. That said, the glamour may well be real. A successful politician is often as not a natural charmer, a seducer skilled at swaying other individuals to his will, and a US president is by definition a very successful politician. Someone who's made his life's work winning over crowds of hostile voters isn't going to be held up for long by the resistance of someone he's identified as a sexual target, unless that person has great strength of will herself. Or himself, because although up to now all America's presidents have been men, so too have several presidential lovers. What Oscar Wilde notoriously called the love that dare not speak its name has certainly kept very quiet in the official annals of the presidency, but in some cases at least it does seem to have been there. There are historical health warnings to be heeded. Men were more openly affectionate toward each other in the 19th century than they've since become. They were far easier going about things like sharing beds. And then there's the question of how far it's safe to talk of anyone being gay, or even homosexual at a time when those very concepts did not exist. All very true, and yet today's gay campaigners are understandably impatient of what they see as attempts to use such scholarly scruples to blind us to facts they feel are staring us in the face. Does the fact that the unmarried James Buchanan played house with Franklin Pierce's Vice President William Rufus King for 15 years prove conclusively that he was gay? Of course it doesn't, but it sure creates some suspicions. And if Buchanan seems a bit minor and also ran in the great presidential race, how about George Washington and Abraham Lincoln? The evidence in these cases is more circumstantial still, but it's been persistent. Some rumors simply will not go away. Dark, not depressing. Considering all these temptations, the surprise is that more presidents haven't painted the White House black as sin, but that elegant residence has certainly seen some goings on. The truth has been anything but edifying at times. Abuse of power is as old as the United States, corruption as American as apple pie. Yet there's no point in being pessimistic or overly depressed. If the city on a hill has often been a Babylon, it surely does us good to recognize our limitations. And to enjoy the spectacle as it unfolds in these pages, for if the history of the US presidency has been a great deal darker than we may imagine, it's also been much more colorful than we assume.